that been the names in there? I don't know.
Like, I was wondering too.
There was one guy who helped me through my entire animal thing, and when I finally got on the video call with him, I was like, oh, it's you, like, everybody never looked back at me, he was like, so fast at replying to, like, all my emails, and I'm like, you're so fast at replying, so, it's been great, like, we have a very good relationship.
That's great.
Yeah, even if they do it.
I also gotta say, I respect your ability to respond to professional emails quickly.
I just do it.
And that is incredible to me.
That is one of my clubs.
I feel equal parts grateful and nervous because this is such an important talk that we've been working on for so many hours. And there's a real impact to our ability to, for us to structure this and for you all to listen. So I can't tell you how much it does mean to me that you showed up in this room. Really my sincerest thanks. So the point of this talk is twofold. It's to get people more excited about the furry fandom and also to highlight the function the furry fandom can have beyond our current fandom spaces. We're giving this talk from ancestral lands of the Adana culture, Hopewell culture, Monongahela peoples, and Osage Nation, who were later joined by refugees of other tribes, including the Delaware, Shawnee, and Haudenosaunee, driven here from their homelands by colonizers. We honor these nations for their historic roles as caretakers and want to highlight indigenous perspectives in how we engage with current events. So, my name is Jonathan.
I'm Sasha.
And we both use he, they pronouns. So we'll do some more intros about us, but first, let's take this opportunity to silence our phones. I have the attention span of a squirrel, so along with silencing phones, I would appreciate if any excited, positive, or angry outbursts were saved until the end of the talk, because the community feedback that we get, it's going to be really important to how we engage. We will have a question and answer section afterwards. This is actually more about you folks here who showed up than it is about us. As a disclaimer, we're not sociologists, psychoanalysts, or therapists. We're curious creatives who know a lot of clever and kind folks who shared context generously with us. So take what we say with several grains of salt and let us know how we can do better talks in the future. Let's be real. There are many different kinds of people in this room right now. We all have different nuanced understandings of the world around us, and we are not professionals ourselves that deserve to be at the top of the list. The most important thing we can do in engaging in these topics is for all of us to have humility and compassion for those who want to build community. There's a content warning here. We're going to reference some transphobic remarks later on, and there are other big topics in this talk that we don't take for granted. We promise we wouldn't mention serious issues if we didn't think that it was way more important to talk about them than not. So, this is some of my art. I've been in the furry fandom for about 15 years. I now do commissions to help clients with what they need on a personal level. And after many commissions, I tried personal work, treating myself as my own client. Then I did talks, writing, streams, and many conventions. My commissions became weirder and more involved, and now it's hard to tell what's a commission and what's personal art based on the appearance. I also do silly, simple art during special events sometimes, and I'm a huge fan of all different kinds of art.
So, I'm what they would call furry adjacent. I grew up kind of tangential to the furry fandom as a teenager through things like the Griffin's Guild and seeing art on Elfwood and DeviantArt, stuff like that. So I did introspective art outside of the fandom first. And then brought that energy to the furry fandom through my commissions.
Sasha's work changed, I think, because the fandom gave him the space to be more confident. You know how fursuits can make it easier to be outgoing for people? It feels like furry clients and dealers' dens did a similar thing for his art. So, furry. What is furry, and how it works. Even the title furry is open-ended. For the purposes of making this talk as simple and helpful as possible, let's just quickly build a shared understanding of how we'll use furry.
So, many decades before furry, other fandom spaces existed around science fiction and fantasy. Comic cons evolved from those origins, and then the efforts of impassioned nerds brought us anime cons, which that was especially significant where you start getting cosplay and things like that, this shared sort of creative attitude. But those are still all celebrating something around pre-existing IPs. So that's where the furry fandom is really different.
You are the show in comic. Most of us in the room get this, but outside furry, it's hard for most people to imagine so much art based off of community of personal characters. The thing that we take for granted, having personas, can look like art of a story, TV show, or game to outsiders. For all the fiction we produce, there's a lot of truth behind it. However, when is something anthro, but not furry? Especially in the United States, we live in a society that values money above all else. Buying and selling happens all the time in the furry fandom. However, the function of this buying and selling of art is relational. The furry fandom's main function is not, nor has it ever been, just about making money. And this is important in defining what furry actually is. Furry as a noun, by example. If you like anthropomorphic subjects in art, you can count as a furry if you want to. If you really like Tony the Tiger, you're a furry if you say you are. If you have 425 images of Tony the Tiger porn saved to your phone, I won't feel bad in calling you a furry. Furry as an adjective, by example. If anthropomorphic art is paid for by corporations with the intent to sell something, it is just anthro art and not furry art. Advertisements of Tony the Tiger are anthro, but they are not furry. The furry fandom overlaps with corporations, but it's an art community that is not corporate. By this logic, is all porn of Tony the Tiger furry as an adjective? Probably, unless porn of Tony the Tiger is commissioned by Kellogg's to sell something. And it's just anthro until furries do something with it.
So this distinction is really important. Most of the imagery we consume outside the furry fandom, and even the platforms we use to see furry art, are largely about making money. When someone commissions porn of Tony the Tiger, it's because a client is attracted to facets of his character. It's not because they're using the image rights from the porn commission to generate money by selling prints, t-shirts, and decorative plates. In 99.9% of furry commissions, money buys a commodity, and it ends there. Your persona was drawn by an artist you love, and this brought you joy. It hangs on your wall, it's upgraded to your Telegram, your Twitter, whatever, E621 if you want, because you want to share the thing that you like with others. Meanwhile, the artist received money for this that they needed to survive by paying the artist and creating a product. That was the entire point of this exchange.
So, furry, why do we care about this stuff?
No one will be surprised to hear that most furries at a convention are male. Gay porn is the most popular upload on websites, despite the subject of most porn uploaded to furry sites being hetero or solo character. Maybe you notice, like furry artists, that generally at convention furry demographics are way more trans and non-binary than outside of furry cons. The trans population is 10 times that of the general populace.
Have you noticed artists at furry convention tables are certainly more female than male? Perhaps you also notice them more often visibly NB and trans than those on the other side of the tables. As with other fandoms, the backbone of the furry fandom is still art. Painting, writing, 3D sculpts, song, animation, dance, and more. Furries in particular are an imaginative community centered around story and especially visual celebration. With creativity comes an openness to new experiences, and this openness correlates with the motivation to question one's gender and sexuality.
So designing your persona can be kind of like a character creation process. It could be like LARPing, or...
You could aim to have the space between you and your persona as close as possible. Here, a camping trip with our found family led to campfire charcoal shenanigans for insect protection, which in turn led to inspiration for markings on my persona. You can actually make furry, escapist, or autobiographical based on whatever you decide. It is completely up to you what utility your persona has. We'll be talking about this more in tomorrow's Furry Stereotypes talk. Despite the fantasy evident in anthro subjects, the whole point of the talk is that reality is always included somewhere in these fantastical images. For those of you who've been looking at furry art for a while, think about this. If I show you a drawing of a military-themed German shepherd dog in front of an American flag, you're probably going to think, yeah, that checks out. If you see art of a possum furry protesting fascism, you also go, yep. Your world will not be rocked if I revealed that the possum persona was trans and or non-binary, even without structuring interviews for qualitative data. There are reasons this makes sense to all of us. Even if you haven't thought of the difference between bunnies and hares before, look for it the next time you search for furry art. You'll probably recall relevant examples you saw in the past that remind you of this image. Everyone has these expectations for their characters, whether or not they even realize it. This tells us so much so often that patterns emerge. That's why those species stereotypes exist and are extremely relatable. While sharing parts of yourself you normally wouldn't share, the furry fandom is connecting you to a lot of human beings who would not otherwise get a chance to interact with you. This is especially important for those of us who are from difficult backgrounds such as unhealthy family dynamics, morally oppressive locales, etc.
As a member of the furry fandom, you have a significant bridge into connecting with people in different cultures because furry itself is a shared subculture. Even if someone has a different first language, you already have a lot of shared understandings because of furry. We were invited to confer in Guadalajara as guests a couple years ago, and it taught us a lot about the often underrepresented and very fresh parts of Latin American furry. So please support this underrated convention if you get a chance to go. We also go over to Berlin for your friends because we have a lot of our like personal art community, or people who follow us for art are over there.
The furry community's diversity is what exposed me to German, Spanish, Deaf cultures, and more. So for the curious person, the furry fandom incentivizes language and culture studies by exposure. Furry is growing in places we can't even see it. There are furries in West Africa. There are furries in Iran. Each government's relationship to sexuality and the English-speaking world, particularly the U.S., and accessibility of the internet, affect how visible these perspectives will be to us unless we take those deep dives on our own. Furry populations in Russia continue to grow. They've held multiple furry cons, but as influential groups propose labeling all LGBT groups, including furries, as extremist, how will this change? Each furry convention has its own respective stats on ethnicity. Furry Week in Atlanta will obviously be more black than Furlandia in Portland. That aside, a 2020 online study from FurScience shows non-white ethnic representation increasing. This is because, despite furries' unique qualities from region to region, we are ultimately a microcosm of the world at large. But when we talk about demographics and furry, including the studies, let's not forget that we vote with our money, and those with more money get more votes. People showing up to conventions can afford to go, or are covered by financially sound friends. Compared to the status quo, sure, we could count as progressive, but there are many, many more people who can't afford to take time off work, or perhaps physical disability or limited access keeps them from joining. Unless we're seeking out these unreached people and fulfilling their needs, furry will always be limited by what we decide to do outside of the furry fandom.
But who gets to show up to a con or not is about more than just material resources. It's also about who feels safe showing up in a space. What does someone dressing like a cop or in military attire at a furry con think they are saying with their outfit? Their assumption about what they're projecting is probably something like that they enjoy serving and protecting and keeping the peace. But does everyone around them at the furry con feel the same way? No, the people around them generally do not feel the same way, whether they're aware of this or not. I don't think this feels like a contribution to the space to furries who are anything along the lines of BIPOC, disabled, queer, trans, deaf, immigrants. When these people see these uniforms, they begin a threat level calculation in their heads. When I see someone dressed like this in the dealer's den, I tend to divert my attention and hope that they don't come to my table because I don't want to have that interaction. I don't want to be, on the one hand, being polite, while also in the back of my mind thinking, like, what does this person think of me? What do they think they're saying? Because this can happen, like, they're anywhere on a spectrum between just kind of oblivious and unaware to deliberately making a statement with that outfit. And that's a lot to process when I'm just trying to be polite and do my job in a space where I am required to be professional in order to make my income. So this could be a deliberate doubling down on the message of their presentation. At this point, post George Floyd, etc., it's pretty hard to write this off as just being tone deaf. When conventions have their code of conduct engage with this topic, but only insofar as to ban the most overt of symbols, the result is pretty awkward. One furry con tried to ban anything German as a way of restricting Nazi symbolism, which is a pretty blatant lack of engaging with the matters at play here. Well, on the note of conventions that are positively engaging with the topic, TFF put in rules in place just banning any sort of military-style uniform, which is pretty effective because then they can't just go back to World War I. We still know what they're saying there. So I think that's the most appropriate handling I've seen of this issue. If these people really did want to contribute in a service or leadership position, then I would expect someone to just go and apply to work for security at the con, as opposed to just kind of dressing up, and really it's about representation of a violent institution at that point. So it can be easy to forget that our experiences in the fandom are irrevocably linked to our conditions outside of it, especially if you already came out of one closet to get into furry, and you get to relax and enjoy having arrived here. But because furry is mostly online and historically cis, white, and male, what is considered right or normal for furry is a contentious topic, and that often leads to punching down. You've probably heard the argument of the furry fandom is just for fun, which is often used as a shield against the discomfort of talking about anything perceived as politics. However, that ignores that for many people, their very existence is politicized in ways they didn't ask for and don't get to choose. To claim that the furry fandom is just for fun is to elevate your own priorities rather than to accept that the fandom is many things for many different people, and not everyone has their needs met enough for the fandom to be something they can or should view exclusively as an escape. You may know what I mean when I say that some people are gay but not queer. There is a certain institutional aspect of cis gay culture which has replicated heteronormativity into, well, a sort of homonormativity, delegating people into the genders of top and bottom, or assigning the institution of marriage as the end goal of our civil rights, rather than just letting the fight more or less end there. For some, the end goal is also to access the institutions of power for yourself, not to dismantle those unequal hierarchies. To settle for less than materially defending the most marginalized among us will inevitably lead to the deterioration of rights for more and more people. Not caring enough to listen and advocate for people has consequences. In the wake of Roe v. Wade being overturned, federal laws protecting sodomy and gay marriage are also being called into question by conservative justices, which means we may find the loss of those protections on the docket for next year. The loss of Roe v. Wade is significant, but not isolated, and it's just one step in a larger pattern. In early June, right after we gave this talk at BLFC, this event occurred in Dallas, where self-described Christian fascists showed up to harass local queers in their own neighborhood. I'm sure you've seen multiple other events like this go down in the past month. The occurrence of COVID shortened the timeline on a lot of building tensions. Fascism is rising even faster than those of us with our eye on it expected, and we need to work together now and fast to get organized against it. Fascism is evolving, and it's updated with the times and the conditions of our modern world. Those expecting it to present as a strictly swastika-shaped thing must update their expectations. Trans people have found ourselves to be the wedge around which this acceleration is happening. We are an easy target to use for those seeking to appeal to people's fear in order to garner social and political power to their own ends. And our very existence is an unallowable threat to their ideologies. The gender binary is one of the most basic hierarchies of our modern Western society. This is why gender nonconformity is such a radical thing. If you exist outside the gender binary and you build dynamic and thriving queer family structures, then the other structures of our society also come into question as false constructs. The nuclear family is revealed as something enforced rather than natural law. This is why both the left and the right lean on queerness as an issue. Don't get me wrong, it absolutely sucks to have your existence be a tug-of-war battleground, but we must remember that that's because our existence is powerful.
For the record, I understand that him putting this fascist in his bio is a joke, but we all know a joke is not a joke when it's about this. This has all happened before. 100 years ago, Berlin was a beacon for progress for queer and trans liberation. When the Nazi book burnings began in 1933, the first major target was Magnus Hirschfeld's Institute of Sex Research, where the first modern transgender healthcare was being provided, and where the words transvestite and transsexual were coined in 1910 and 1923, respectively. A century of progress was stolen from us. Where would we be now if we could have prevented fascism from reaching this point in the first place?
On the bright side, furries do sometimes fight anti-queer and trans government action and have been successful. When furries get together and make noise, people notice. Our novelty, the thing that makes us outcasts previously, can now be leveraged to make greater impact in normie spaces. Most furries grew up with Anthro Children's Program. I'm so sorry about this, sir. You didn't deserve to see that. Most furries grew up with Anthro Children's Programming. We imprinted onto fantastical characters before eventually developing sex drives. This could make the cartoon a comfortable nostalgia for us in original format or even sexed up. While we don't necessarily need to abandon our childhood interests, it is important that we do not merely settle for nostalgia. We can be grateful that we grew up with Disney, but let's not kid ourselves. Disney did not purchase the rights to Star Wars because it loves creativity, art, or any one fans of any one thing. The entertainment industry is not about making you happy. It's about selling Kylo Ren bedsheets to 10-year-olds. It's a good thing that Disney isn't selling work here, too. Because of our otherness and the status quo, we have some level of protection from the furry fandom turning into another money grab. Furry still operates under capitalism today, of course, but with sex positivity and a lot more openness and generosity. An apt comparison to furry culture would be the burners that attend festivals like Burning Man or the art-centric performance gatherings of Wastelanders. While I made this meme myself and only showed it in early versions of this talk, I've since seen other people create the exact same meme at least 4 separate times. This is not because I'm somehow smart or cool for thinking this up. It's because this phenomenon is playing out so blatantly that it's hard to ignore.
After the first iteration of this talk, I spoke with Sable Griff, the former con chair of TFF, about some of these issues. She brought up a big concern she has. Keeping a major convention afloat has only gotten more difficult post-COVID, and she expects that some of our large-scale conventions may fall through due to these difficult circumstances. If 2 or 3 of them goes down, this opens the gateway for corporate entities to step in and fill the void, and to create their own corporate-scale furry cons run by non-furry organizers just here to profit from us. If we lose ownership and agency over our own conventions, the furry fandom will face a spiritual death. It will rot from the outside in. We have worked both comic and furry cons, and they're very different places. Comic cons can feel almost kind of vampiric once you are acclimated to furry and all the things going on here.
If the grassroots creator factor is valuable to you, furry dealers then should probably not include non-furry run corporations, overly mass-produced images, designs and art ripped directly from other artists and IPs and garage sales. And we should at least have discussions about furry-run businesses that produce nothing related to anthro, animal, or science fiction fantasy art in a furry's dealer's den. If it plugged into a socially organized thing, that's fine. Plugged into capitalist infrastructure, it tends to screw up. Limited space should grant priority to furry creators doing furry things, but if you get the kind of people who show up who don't understand that the work that you do in the first place is valuable to you as a human being and represents your friendships, you're not going to like what builds momentum from that.
Imagination has a utility, and even if we aren't doing all we can with our imaginations, the imagination in furry sets us apart in a good way. For a better world, we have to imagine something before we can pursue it. Being visionaries is part of what we must task ourselves with moving forward.
Can furries save the world? We had this idea for a talk back in 2019, focused on the question, can furries save the world? Here's the consensus we reached.
No. So we were going to give this apocalypse talk at BLFC 2020, and then we couldn't because the world locked down, so that's funny.
Good joke.
But there's something valuable about the idea we wanted to insert. Each time there was a thing furry was failing at, it was an opportunity for us to start talking about building.
Seriously, though, what can we do? In a moment here, we're going to give you 10 seconds to think on a question that we're going to ask, and don't say it out loud after, just hold on to it for later. And here's that question. What would you want out of the fandom if you could have absolutely anything? It does not matter how impractical it is. So, 10 seconds. Think about it, starting now. Until recently, I thought I had some really good answers, but something got in my way. And we are going to revisit this question and your answers too. But the most important thing to address here is that our answers are determined by what we think is even allowed to exist as humans under a current system. What counts as realistic might not be the best case scenario for you. And if it's hard for you to imagine your needs being met, there's probably a very good reason for that.
We've got a lot of work to do before we can get even close to language like saving the world. That's because we still have many blind spots in how we see our own spaces. Because community is so visual here, we could easily create art of furry friends that care about things like growing food or building local connections. Make community sexy, and also define it beyond making friends.
Unfortunately, it's a very furry thing to support no-kill animal shelters while remaining ignorant to greater problems like deforestation. Saving kitties and puppies one at a time is easier to interface with than considering deforestation and mass extinction from climate change and capitalism. It is nice that furries want to give to causes like animal shelters, but often these choices for charity are more about us feeling good for contributing to something non-controversial, as well as us understanding immediate consequence where we can see and hold it. Supporting charity is a nice start, but it must be part of a larger strategy if we are to build a future.
However, conventions themselves are almost always 501c3 nonprofits, so this places some limits on what conventions can officially support or not. Though one con chair told us that, in practice, this limitation is mostly about not being able to endorse politicians and other election-related matters. Still, this is a good opportunity to address the matter of what political even means. Most of the people in this room have some sense of their existence being politicized, whether they asked for it or not. And in some places in the U.S., even just feeding people who can't afford to eat is a criminalized act. And, of course, even believing in climate change is a political stance in this country. So yeah, we're going to have to risk getting political sometimes if we want to get literally anything done of substance. I am not convinced that there is anything in this world that is completely apolitical. I mean, even look at, like, color, like, how that's been impacted by the trade of pigments and dyes, what color will reserve for royalty, and in our modern world, what does it mean for a man to wear a neon pink shirt? That's got politics in it.
Why does this disconnect from reality keep happening? Furries or not, people usually don't participate in these systems of government, and it's not because we're stupid or lazy. Things are getting less and less stable, and people burn out. Most people directly affected by huge issues don't get the chance to learn and adapt unless they work together. Our producing this talk and your attending the talk is way outside the status quos for furry and non-furry. So nothing about us without us. Means not making decisions, including legislation, creation of structures, and more, about a group of people without their direct participation and involvement. For example, lawmaking around accessibility for the disabled should not be taking place without disabled people leading the discussion and having a hand in writing those terms. Most humans, let alone furries, don't know that they're allowed to have the standard, but they can. Let's talk about charity versus mutual aid. Back to traditional charity, since we talked about that before, it has its limitations. Charity temporarily addresses symptoms rather than resolving problems. Charity is a top-down approach, the haves giving to the have-nots. Example, Haitians can't afford food, so we'll give them money for meals. In contrast, mutual aid is a bottom-top approach, accepting that our lives are intrinsically tied to others. Last year, our online little chunk of the furry community worked with the Rapid Response Network, which connected us to the Haitian-run labor committee, Bataille Ouvrier. They were raising money to organize workers to publicly struggle for livable wages. Previously, I would have raised money and maybe mentioned what the cause was on the side while churning out furry art. This time, I made sure an organization rep got to present directly to our viewers through the Twitch stream. We also showed clips of a documentary and shared photos of protesters. It was important to trust viewers with things that were not at all furry. My viewers liked seeing furry art done in KidPix, the program I used, but many were also genuinely interested in understanding the cause we were supporting. After our community raised over $3,000, Rapid Response Network told us this was the first time that they actually hit their financial goal. Rapid Response Network reps did not expect to find solidarity from furries, but it was our involvement that made a huge difference. How huge of a difference would be this? This mass demonstration was the work of months and months and months of planning, and the donations that we were raising was for education purposes, transporting workers to education sites where they can actually learn what wages are in a very detailed way. So 3K doesn't seem like a large number, but it made it possible for this demonstration to happen. Haitians do not have livable wages yet, but their minimum wage increased fourfold. We will continue to support their struggles for power over their oppressors whenever we can. I'm the most excited, however, for furries building up human solidarity, protecting ecosystems, and directly confronting the biggest issues affecting the planet. Despite this small victory, we learned a lot we could do better. I took out months of free commissions to raise money, and this became a bit of a financial stress on our household. That grind was well-intentioned, and it did what it had to do, but it was not the best way for furries to efficiently affect positive change.
Oh, no.
Sorry, everyone. It's hard when you're using a different monitor.
Yeah! Before we can get furries on board with this kind of stuff, we need them to believe change is possible, and that's a very doable goal. Furry is already great at giving us the space to tap into our dreams on our personal level. For many of us, it was the first hint we got of identity exploration. We're actually great at changing as individuals once we're given a chance. So why not at least wonder what we could do if we started thinking in terms of imagining societies? If the people with the most privilege dictate what counts as normal or acceptable in the furry fandom, it'll likely galvanize into a horny, cis-gay version of the status quo. Most attempts to privatize and commoditize the furry fandom with luxury labels or corporate sponsorships haven't gained traction. Without weird porn or weirdos speaking up constantly against these attempts, the furry fandom will become significantly worse. It will then have little chance of improving our big picture at all. Just look at how the Canine Cartels, which was an NFT attempt at the anthro, but not furry. He was very offended at being compared to furries. He was so upset at having anything to do with sexual or you know, weird furry art at all. So this was really threatening, and we did a great job of shutting this down. So as long as we are on top of understanding the grassroots value of furry and staying vigilant to those trying to corporatize it, furry will remain very hard to co-opt.
A lack of an ongoing in-person coexistence has fractured our community. Over the years, an increase in multiple unwarranted blow-ups started happening to some friends on multiple occasions over the last 3 years. And now this conflict is not just drama that we can write off. Why is communicating so hard for everyone? Isolation during COVID, climate crisis, George Floyd protests, Trump, and then Biden. Many of us were navigating personal trauma before this, and now anyone who isn't traumatized likely isn't paying attention. So while self-care and boundaries are important, we can't wait until things are easier to confront these problems. Online communication sucks. Social media sucks. But do we really want to find solace and risk vulnerability in a fandom where we're worried about being canceled without a chance for redemption? Politics can be messy, but call-outs on outspoken political positions, they're at least not down to a he said, she said. Placing accountability on interpersonal issues includes many more variables. It's often easier for people to believe whichever side of a dispute managed to raise their voice first. In general, going public with a personal conflict should be a last resort, only after private and small group communication efforts have proven futile. It could not be a first resort in hopes of gaining stability, or it should not be a first resort in hopes of gaining stability or clout. Even with a mess, we can still do this. We can love without coddling. We can kick out toxic people while still promoting rehabilitation. We can hold tension in relationships without being enablers. How can we facilitate a calling in for discussions over a calling out? Some folks in this room don't actually know what it's like to have community with consistent and open communication. To them, it might seem unreasonable to expect mature emotional discourse from anyone. Social media is not the same as muting or blocking someone the moment you don't like something, and we say this as people who sometimes need to mute or block people for our own safety. If we continue prioritizing online lifestyles over building in-person community, we will be done for. If you can't develop these skills now, even as an in-person support group, you won't necessarily be able to be supported in, I don't want to say real life, but off of internet space. Because the majority of in-person communication's body language, cadence, and inflection, rather than simply speech, good luck getting that done in a Telegram group chat.
So, from my further conversations with con chairs, furry cons are not an authority, even though they're treated like one. As furries especially, we're primed to view authority with suspicion, and this isn't a bad impulse, but when applied to conventions, people often assume that these organizations hold more power or wealth than they really do. Furry cons can make enough money to be able to put the convention on again the following year, but not much else. Furry cons could do so much more, but not while they lack the resources to staff and fund additional programs. If we want to ask more of conventions, then we first must ask more of ourselves. Most cons are understaffed, especially post-COVID. You can kind of notice that here, that things are a little bit bare bones in terms of getting people where they need to be in certain functions. You can either hope for the best, or you and your friends can sign up for volunteer slots. Even a single hour of helping the entire weekend, it makes a difference. Another major con chair we spoke to said that with the current on-hand resources, that particular convention could continue running for another 3 years, but if they don't get an uptick in participation and volunteer stuff, then that's kind of it. What if volunteering at a con brought with it a certain sort of social credit? If it had the community reputation of being an admirable service to provide? Together, creators, and creatives, artists, we can initiate this cultural shift. We started offering a 10% discount at our table for anyone who staffs volunteer, whether it's at this con or another con. And we would love it if more healers started offering that and publicly displaying that fact to sort of get a little bit of light peer pressure going on that front. We could also have artists doing art